March 21st, 2017, meeting of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Good afternoon to everyone. Going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5537, the Department of State Lands. And Matt, can you give us a little background, please?
Sure. Co-Chair Witt, today we have in front of us Department of State Lands. They're here to present their 2017 through 19 biennium governor's budget. Fortunately, this is a nice quiet agency with nothing controversial going on. And so
when I'm up to class, can I? We'll see about that.
Yeah, wait till the ODF&W budget.
So, in our in the LFO overview document that's on OLIS, we go through a description of the agency's general programs, and then a little bit of a discussion about the current service level, which is pretty straightforward. There are some phase outs of funds that were provided to the agency in the last biennium, particularly to do some work that were related to policy bills. And in the governor's budget, really, it can be summarized into two categories. There's a continuance, funding for continuance of programs that started in the last biennium or prior biennium, and then some expansion of agency capacity for some ongoing operations. So for the ongoing stuff, there's additional limitation requested dealing with Attorney General expenses for the Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup. There's also requested limitation to continue the work that was initiated by Senate Bill 912, dealing with the identification and dealing with the I'm pretty sure this is 912 is the identification of historically filled lands and the notification to landowners. So the agency has done some work, and I'm sure they'll describe it to you in this biennium, but they have work that needs to be done in the upcoming biennium. Mm-hmm. Still with that, and so they're asking for a couple of limited duration positions to deal with that. Also, House Bill 2436 passed last biennium for the identification and cleaning up or removal of derelict structures, vessels, and debris on state-owned waterways. And so the agency is looking for a little additional limitation to deal with that. For capacity expansion, there's a request and limitation to lease some office space in Portland, deal with vehicle replacement costs, sage-grouse preservation, trust land management, and some facilities maintenance. So that's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome, Director Paul.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee. Happy to be here before you this afternoon. And we have 3 days scheduled with you, today and tomorrow. We intend to be presenting our budget and our work, and then Thursday is our public comment day. And what I'd like to do, if this works for the committee, is one, right off the bat, recognize that a couple of issues, I think, are two that we will probably be spending a lot of time talking through with you and answer your questions. And those two are the Elliott State Forest and the Portland Harbor Superfund site. As much as feasible as it works for you, my thought is that today I would devote to basically going through the agency and budget overview, and probably being able to get through that today, and tomorrow being focusing entirely, almost entirely, on those two topics. In fact, I have one of our DOJ attorneys on our Portland Harbor Superfund team scheduled to join me tomorrow to help with the Portland Harbor discussion and presentation. And I just was reminded I haven't identified myself. I'm Jim Paul, the director of the Department of State Lands.
Thank you.
So if that works, yes. I'll proceed with our
please do
agency and budget overview.
Thank you.
Just a quick slide on the department itself and the origins of the department. The Department of State Lands is the administrative arm of Oregon State Land Board. The State Land Board is established at statehood, and by their office, by the Constitution, it's composed of the governor as the chair, Secretary of State, and the treasurer. The origins of the department also began with the granting of 3.4 million acres of school trust land by the federal government to fund K through 12 education. This came in within Oregon's Admissions Act, that these lands be managed primarily for schools. And over the course of the 150 years since statehood, the case law on that across Western states, across the country, have clarified that to mean maximizing revenue from those land assets over time for schools. The revenue from school trust lands are deposited into the Common School Fund, and we distribute earnings based on the Land Board's distribution policy to schools twice a year. In 2017, those amounted to about $70 million in distributions. The fund value as of January 31st of this year is $1.49 billion. Over time, since statehood, the department's jurisdiction, purview, responsibilities have grown. And you'll see those as you look at our agency structure and our major programs. You'll see the pieces of the department that have grown over time. Of course, as I just said, it started with the school lands at statehood. Two other things were also granted to the department at statehood, which is managing the estates without heirs and wills, our estates administration program, and also state-owned waterways. So the department also manages all state-owned waterways that were navigable at statehood. In the 1950s, Unclaimed Properties Program was added to the agency, and those funds, essentially, they earn money for the Common School Fund while we are holding them and as we search for the rightful owners or wait for the rightful owners to claim their property. In the 60s and 70s, we added the Removal Fill Program that regulates all removal and fill from waters of the state, which is different than state-owned waters, although there is some overlap there, as well as wetlands. And then in the 70s, the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve was added, the first of, I believe, 26 national estuaries across the country. That's based out of Charleston, which is near Coos Bay, and we also manage that program under our umbrella. And we had wetland conservation and mitigation program added in 1989. And the programs listed here you'll see are how we're structured currently as an agency. Under our Common School Fund Property Program, we have both our real property and our trust property divisions. Our Aquatic Resource Management Program is all things water, everything to do with water. Our Business Operations and Support Services, of course, supports the entire agency work. And then the South Slough Estuary, as I just mentioned. So just a quick breakdown of how our budget breaks down across our different programs. The next couple slides just show our major operating programs along with our other programs delineated in our budget and the FTEs associated with those programs as well as the dollar amounts. And these are our remaining pieces of our budget and our programs up there, operations and support, director's office, our removal fill mitigation fund, and our capital improvement. I'll go into some detail here shortly, specifically on each of the major programs to break down what falls under these budgets, these parts of our budget. Uh, I do want to mention, and this is in the packet, in our packet that came as included with the presentation, we recently updated our agency strategic plan. Our last strategic plan went through 2016. We've just updated it for the next 5 years. And that strategic plan is structured based on 5 major goals that align very closely with each of our programs. And I'll try to make the connections between these goals and especially our POPs that are in our budget, our requested budget, and as I go through the presentation. And just to reiterate those goals, the first one, goal number one, is to deliver consistent, timely, and dependable public service and to reach out to customers to understand their needs. This is really an overarching goal across the agency, across all of our programs. Goal number two is anchored essentially into our Common School Trust Lands work and our Real Property program, and that is to manage that program to meet our trust responsibilities. The third is to serve as trustee for unclaimed property and estates with no will and no known heirs. Goal number four is to protect Oregon waters through Oregon's removal fill permit and wetlands conservation laws and protect public trust values on state-owned waters. And number five is to provide leadership and administrative oversight for the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve. So the next 5 slides are around our 15 key performance measures. And I just want to check in here. One thing I wanted to mention at the beginning was just to make sure that as I go through our presentation today, an overview of our budget, I'm hoping that I'm adding value for all of you in the committee in terms of understanding the agency and the budget. I know you all have received a pile of paper around the budget itself and the material behind it. So feel free to stop me at any time if there's anything in here you want to have any questions about or want to drill in any deeper. So the next 5 slides will be around our key performance measures. We have 16 key performance measures. They're numbered 1 through 17, and that's because one of them was dropped to the biennium before last. So we have 16. These KPMs include essentially measurements around all of our major operating programs as well as our administrative functions. The Common School Fund investment activities, so the actual management of the fund itself, the land board has delegated that work to the Oregon Investment Council. Those activities are not included in our KPMs because those are essentially outside of the realm of control in terms of specifically how the fund is managed and decisions around investments around the fund. So you won't see any KPMs specifically around the investment activities of the fund. You can see the percentage of green, yellow, and red in terms of the current results on our KPMs, and I'll walk through each of those within our 4 KPMs, or excuse me, our 16 KPMs, starting with the first 4. The first one, increase in deposits to the Common School Fund, we are showing in the green, so we're meeting our target there. The second one in the red, and this has actually been the case for a number of years. The second KPM has 2 parts to it, 2A and 2B. 2A is specifically around the performance of the forest lands. And, of course, we've been in the red because of the Elliott for a number of years and are working actively to resolve that situation. 2B is around the rest of the revenues that come in to the fund off of our lands. And those have actually been in the red lately. We've been in large part due to increased fire costs on our rangelands. So we don't make a lot of money on all of the rest of our trust lands, partly mostly because of the nature of those lands. Their large majority of them are rangelands, and it doesn't take a whole lot of expenditures around fire protection to increase those operating costs and overseeing those lands. KPM number 3 is increase in revenues from land management. And in here, this is actually in the red because of an accounting adjustment that had to occur post-fiscal year. So it was a technical error in terms of accounting that occurred after the fiscal year that had to be back corrected. So it shows a negative, but in fact, we expect that that number actually, had it been accounted for in the proper fiscal year, would have shown very similar results to the past years, which is just a modest modest increase in terms of the increase in revenues from land management activities. Number four, complete management plans or policies on trust lands. This is actually a measure that at some point we intend to expire. This measure really came out of the previous real estate asset management plan for the department. This is the 10-year strategic plan that the land board adopts. In the 2006 version, the part of the intent of that plan was to complete management plans across all of our trust lands. We completed about enough plans to cover 89% of our trust lands, and in the 2012 asset management plan and the update, we actually changed our approach to how we do that. We no longer actually go through completing those, so we've stayed right at 89% and have not changed from that, and eventually intend to expire that measure. The next five KPMs have to do with our removal fill and wetlands work. Measure number five, this is a measure that is one that is really most useful when we're looking back over the long term. And so over the long term, because we'll see annual variability, and it's anchored into our permitting activity versus our mitigation bank activity. Those are the pluses and minuses that go in. And in a given year, we can have a plus or a minus based on the level of one or the other. But over time, our long-term trend is actually a net gain in wetlands since 2005. Part of what occurred last year as well as the previous year is really approval of no additional mitigation banks. And that's where we add to the plus column. But we continue to have our permit activities move forward where we do see in terms of the permitting itself, we see impacts to wetlands. But as I said, over time, the trend does show a net gain. And again, this just covers wetlands that's within the department's purview and control, which is the permitting and the wetland mitigation banks. We don't have a database or the ability to track absolutely all of the wetlands across the entire state and a no net loss in that context. It's really in the context of our activity and our authority under the removal fill mandate. Number six is the number of days for a permit decision. And this one is also somewhat confusing. We have an internal target of 60 days, and that's why this is in the red. We saw an increase in permit activity in 2016 versus 15. 15 we had 315, and 16 we had 365, so longer processing time. What the statute requires is that we respond within 120 days. So in terms of the statutory requirements, we're well within the statutory requirements, but we set internally a 60-day goal that we shoot for, and it's in the red because we did not hit that 60-day average in 2016. Number seven is around annual resolution of permit noncompliance, and this is in the red, and this, again, is actually something similar to the last few years, so not a real change in our trend, but continue to be just in the red on this. And a big factor that has made it actually difficult for the department to get out of the red is that when we are working on resolving non-compliant with permit, there is only so much that's within our control. So when we're resolving, there's a back and forth between the applicant. So sometimes it's in the ball's in our court in terms of getting the work done and being responsive, and then other times we're waiting for the permittee to respond. And if they take longer, because they need to take longer, they do, and we simply can't control that. And number eight, where we are showing in the green, is the annual resolution of violations related to unauthorized activities. So this is where we find after the fact there was an activity that never did have a permit, and then we need to resolve that, either get it under permit, or if there was damage to the resource, deal with that situation. And the next The next four, 9 and 10, I was not going to get into any detail on. We're in the green on those two. 11, that's showing a red. This is around the use of payment for mitigation monies. So, and this is the fact that we simply didn't obligate any funds to wetland mitigation projects in FY 2016. We essentially have adequate mitigation banks and availability of wetland mitigation across the state, with the exception of the South Umpqua watershed, and we've simply been unable to because we're somewhat dependent on the private sector, whose willingness to create a bank. We did not obligate any funds for that area, so we simply didn't have any additional wetland mitigation funds obligated last year, so that showed up as a red. And number 12 is our unclaimed property holder reporting. We actually had quite unusually high results there. It was in the green, but it was unusually high results, in part because of the number of securities that we actually had to cash out that year. We had a change in our brokerage firm that we use for those securities, and this metric doesn't count the reporting until it turns into cash. So we had this big surge in cash because we had to make that change. That's showing a high result. Nonetheless, we do continue to see sort of record highs in terms of reporting relative to historic on our unclaimed properties, in the vicinity to $50 to $60 million a year. That has been coming into the department for quite a few years now. And the last four, number 13, we are showing in the green in terms of customer service. Number 14 was removed a couple of biennia ago, so that's why it's not listed there. 15 and 16 is around the South Slough estuary. Number 15 is actually one that needs to be fixed. So the reason this is showing in red is because it measures the percentage of grant monies that are awarded for operational expenses, and actually it's fairly unusual for grant monies to go towards operational expenses, so we really don't expect this number to be very high. And number 16, we were in the green last year and went to the red this year because of a change in the target. So our number has been the same. It's been at 75% for a number of years, and the target changed from 60% to 100% last by end of this biennium. So we went from the red or the green to the red. And 17 was just an anomaly. This is to measure the best practices of the agency's board and director. We had three directors in fiscal year 16. My predecessor, Mary Abrams, left. We had an interim director for 4 months, and then I took over for the last 4 months. So not a meaningful measure necessarily for that particular year. And that is concludes presentation in terms of the KPMs. Be happy to answer any questions on those if there are any.
Senator Girard?
Yeah, and I try to ask most of the agencies, the KPMs, is there any that you're not super happy with, that you don't really feel that you manage your program? Because I got a feeling we're spending a tremendous amount of time and waste of money on some KPMs that we might not actually need.
Yeah. Chair Witt, Senator Girard, with the exception of a few that, I think serve a purpose, where because we know they're being measured, we're paying attention to making sure we're paying attention to what we're doing related to those. For the most part, these are measures that we compile once a year for the purposes of the requirement to do so. And we've talked about many of them for years, needing to update them or revamp them. They don't on balance drive our daily work, and in large part they're measuring outputs rather than outcomes. And sometimes, whether you're even measuring outcomes, we don't have complete control over those outcomes, so they're difficult to show in terms of a true indicator of the department's efforts and our work and what we're actually within our purview to control. That answers your question.
Anyone else? Okay.
Okay, next, I'm going to give a quick overview of our real property program. So this program is really around managing our common school fund real property to meet our trust responsibilities. We manage about 1.5 million acres of common school trust lands. About half of those are in uplands, and the other half are subsurface ownership. Those are lands that, since statehood, we have sold the surface rights but retained the subsurface rights for the potential mineral and energy resources. And the management responsibilities around these lands are fairly distinct, and that is to obtain full market value from the sale, rental, and use of these Admissions Act lands while conserving the corpus of the trust. The large majority of these lands are rangelands in eastern Oregon, over 600,000 acres. And the next largest block of lands is forest land, which is about 122,000 acres, and that includes the Elliott within those acres. And then we have just under 7,000 acres of industrial commercial residential lands, about 6,000 acres of agricultural lands, and then about 5,500 acres of what we call special stewardship lands, lands that are constrained for some reason or other for management that we essentially hold, continue to hold because we own them, but they don't really have any value, and we maintain them for their special stewardship characteristics. Some of those actually we are able to sell to conservation interests that express an interest in those lands. We just sold a couple of parcels a few years ago in the Hell's Canyon area from an inquiry from a conservation group that wanted to acquire those. But otherwise we hold on to those. And they stay in that category. We have a little over 15 FTE in this program, the budget of $5.3 million. The majority of the staff are based out of our Bend office. That's where we manage these lands. Are statewide, and we manage these lands out of that office primarily, with a couple positions that are located in Salem. And it's guided by the work of that unit is guided by our real estate asset management plan that I already mentioned earlier. And fundamentally, this plan is about growing a consistent stream of revenue from our trust land assets, as well as balancing our revenue generation with resource stewardship. So what are some of our major projects in terms of real property? Of course, we have the Elliott State Forest. That is our major project, again, which we've got all time tomorrow reserved to get into more detail on the Elliott. We are also in the first few years of our sage grouse conservation plan for our eastern Oregon rangelands. This stems from an October 2015 candidate conservation agreement with assurances that we signed with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This was a really important agreement that we signed as an agency. Basically, we were, with the issue of the sage grouse looming and potential listing occurring, we were at risk of actually going down a path that the Elliott started down back in 1990 when the spotted owl was listed. We wanted to get ahead of that issue and essentially protect these trust lands from being encumbered to where they could not meet their mandate. And what this candidate conservation agreement with assurances allowed for us to do was essentially continue, for the most part, managing these lands for revenues for grazing, as we have been, with some minor modifications and some monitoring requirements. The CCAA is the abbreviation. What that does is that provides us protection. As long as we're managing under that agreement, regardless of what happens with the sage grouse, we have federal ESA protection and are not at risk of litigation with that plan in place. So, and you'll see later, there's one of our POPs is, and the intent of that POP is to help support that work, to make sure we can stay under that agreement and that protection. We also are involved in a historical filled lands project, which came out of Senate Bill 912 during the last session. This is actually a very significant project. Since statehood, and mostly during the past century, We have had to wrestle regularly with the notion of unresolved filled lands, where at some point in the past, state-owned waterways have been filled. The upland adjacent landowner, sometimes for generations, believed that land belonged to them. And when they went to sell it or do something on it, they found out that there was a cloud on title and that the state had a potential ownership claim. What Senate Bill 912 did, and it stemmed out of a work group that occurred in the biennium leading up to that, was basically create a fixed time frame of 10 years that, providing the department had the resources to do so, the department was committed to basically inventorying and identifying all filled lands in the state of Oregon that the state believes it may have an ownership claim to. And once identified, putting that information out there for the public, and once that 10-year elapsed, there would be no additional ownership claims by the state of any filled lands in the future. And the goal there is to create that uncertainty that all Oregonians would know. They'd be able to check that database and know whether or not they believe they may be on or adjacent to state-owned filled lands, and there wouldn't no longer be any surprises out in the future of someone who believed they owned their land and found out later from the state that maybe they didn't. The one piece that doesn't resolve, because it's a piece that requires two willing parties, is once that's established and the state believes they have a claim, then there's the working out of how to resolve that claim. And again, that step would still need to happen, but at the very least, what this project would achieve is that there would be no more surprises around somebody finding out the state may own it at some uncertain point in the future. In the last biennium, we submitted a POP to complete the first phase of this project, two positions that essentially did the foundational research around that inventory. For various reasons, we found that that work has taken longer and is more involved than we estimated. So we are looking to probably extend that work. We're going to try to get the resource to extend that work into the next biennium. But at the same time, we want to begin that next phase of the project, which is what the POP that we currently have in the budget right now, which is POP 102, which is the notification, the outreach and notification to the public once we have that mapping is complete, because that's part of the Senate bill as well, is that we need to notify in a certain way to make sure the public is aware that they may own lands in this category. The final major project I just wanted to mention is around agricultural conversions on some of our eastern Oregon rangelands. A few years back, we started to look at more proactive about ways in which we could generate money off of our school trust lands, and identified a limited set of rangeland acres that we might be able to convert to irrigated agriculture. We've been working through those projects, and we have a few we're working through to hopefully complete with this biennium. We don't currently have plans yet to start new projects in the next biennium, but would do so if we identified additional opportunities. The significance of these projects is that they'll increase the revenue off these lands 25-fold, from about $2 an acre equivalent with grazing and rangelands to as much as $50 an acre when you're leasing irrigated agricultural lands. While it can be potentially very lucrative on an acre per acre basis, there's not a huge amount of acres out there on the state-owned lands that we could do this with. We estimate it might be, we're looking at hundreds or thousands of acres potentially that could be converted. And at the end, it'll be some subset of that, whereas, we own over 600,000 acres. So the large majority are going to stay in rangelands. But where we can find those opportunities for these types of projects, we're going to continue looking there. And then just in terms of overall priorities, these priorities and projects are documented in our strategic plan, which is part of your packet there. I would just want to highlight a couple here. One is to a development of a strategy to guide our reinvestment of proceeds from the sale of non-performing property into land or other suitable investments. And this is around work that we've done. In earnest since about 2006, where we are trying to take a ongoing and revolving look at all of our common school trust lands, and where we identify lands that we don't believe can generate revenue or are really struggling to generate revenue and don't have the potential to in the future, we are divesting of those lands And those funds, as a default, sit in the Common School Fund in a sub-account called the Land Revolving Account. And then we look to actually reinvest some of those monies to generate more revenue off of our existing land. So, for example, the agricultural conversions and those types of projects, or we invest them into lands that we are preparing to sell to increase the value of those lands so we can maximize the sale, the revenue we get once we do divest of other properties. The second major project here, just to highlight, is looking forward, is to essentially be more proactive around doing market types of analyses around renewable energy opportunities. As I mentioned, rangeland improvements, forest management, and other potential uses of state trust lands. I'd say historically, the agency has been more of a reactive mode. When folks come knocking on our door and are interested in using leasing state-owned property, we respond. I'm trying to shift that. In the last few years, we're trying to be more proactive, actually go out there and look for opportunities to generate more revenues off of our real property. And then just a few numbers and statistics around our program. Looking back at our three-year average in terms of annual net revenues, we've generated a little over $700,000 a year on average. And this is not including forest lands. This pulls out the forest lands piece because the forest lands are such an anomaly right now because everything's driven so much by what's happening on the Elliott. It's been losing money over the last 4 years. We parse out both numbers. We look at non-forest lands and forest lands themselves, and this is our non-forest land number. We have generated in fiscal year 2015, we've sold over $1 million in lands, divested over $1 million of lands, 459 acres. And we currently have 280 active leases on our Common School Trust lands. About half of those are rangeland leases, and the others are various types of leases. And then on this slide, the three POPs in our budget. I have already talked about POP 102. That's our filled lands project. POP 103 is our trust land management project, and this is actually would provide us with a second property manager. We, outside of our rangelands, we currently only have one property manager. Our rangelands work, we have three that are staffed on our rangelands, but everything else we have just a single property manager in terms of a permanent FTE. This would add a second one and allow us to, again, be much more proactive in terms of managing those lands for revenues. And then I made reference earlier to POP 105, our sage-grouse monitoring. This will allow us the capacity to have a seasonal monitoring work that needs to be done to continue to implement our candidate conservation agreement with assurances for the sage grouse.
Question, Brad?
Senator Girard.
Yeah, can you, maybe I misunderstood, but on POP 103, for one FTE, it's going to cost us $181,000?
Yes.
That's correct.
Yes, that's 2 year.
Oh, it's 2 year.
2 year, yeah.
Humbly apologize.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like everyone that comes before us is monitoring the sage grouse. What are we coordinating this with the other entities or what? I mean, everyone that's been in here has been talking about that.
Sure. Co-Chair Representative Esquivel, this is very specific to, you know, we have an agreement signed by our agency and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife around commitments we have made around all of our leaseholds that are within the areas covered by this agreement. And this monitoring is specific to that. This isn't monitoring about the general condition of the sage grouse or habitat. This is around making sure that those leaseholds are being managed in a way that's consistent with the way we agreed to within that agreement.
But did they have follow-up?
Please.
Yeah. Do they have juniper on those, and are you taking the juniper out?
We may or may not be taking juniper out, depending on the terms of the lease. And if I don't know the specific answer to that question in terms of how often we do that, but it's It's simply monitoring requirements around the impact of our lessees and making sure that we're, you know, we have certain best practices around managing how they water, say, their cattle, or how they maintain their roads, or how they
leasing it out for grazing. Right?
We're leasing it out for grazing. Yeah.
And to follow up on Representative Esquivel's line of questioning, those grazing leases then are sufficient to cover the grazing costs as well as sage-grouse monitoring plus whatever else occurs?
Yes, Co-Chair Witt, with the exception of the plus whatever else, which the big unknown there is fire protection, but not including that, because that one's hard to predict. It is within what we can generate. In fact, we're seeing some of our highest returns yet on those rangelands because of increase in calf prices. We're approaching close to $1 million of net of gross revenues for the first time in the history of the program. Fire is the big variable because we can see those revenues get eaten up very quickly in a bad fire year.
Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When real property is sold, land is sold, can you describe the process? I mean, who determines the value of the land? Is it the land board? What's the process?
Certainly, yes. We do have specific rules, Division 67 rules on how we go about with those transactions. It starts with an internal review of lands that from a staff review we believe we should consider to sell or exchange. And then once we've made that determination, we bring in front of the land board to approve for the department moving forward with doing formal due diligence, is what we call it, well, the review and determination. And that's where we start to actually spend real time and money evaluating the property to decide if we, in fact, think it should be sold. We do, if there are surveys needed around plant or animal species, we do that. We also do formal appraisals to value the land with a private independent appraisal firm that does that for us, and we look at any other issues we think need to be evaluated. And then once we get done with all of that work, the department then decides whether on a formal recommendation to sell, and then it has to come back to the state land board. They have to approve the method of sale, and they also have to approve what it's going to be sold for, the value of the land. And once we get that approval, we move forward. And the typical methods are either a direct sale or a auction or a public auction of the property.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the forests that we own, the Tillamook and the ones we have, we're getting ready to sell. What and the Elliott? What's the percentage of the harvest versus the percentage of the growth in those two forests?
Co-Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, I can address those numbers on the Elliott, on the Tillamook, and on the other state forests. The trust land portion is a very small percentage, and I don't know those numbers off the top of my head. But on the Elliott State Forest, I do know those. Those are the overall annual growth on the Elliott is somewhere between 75 and 80 million board feet is the metric if you were to convert the wood into lumber.
It's just the growth of the wood.
That's all the growth, yeah. Regardless of any kind of state or federal laws around how much is you can harvest, or you know, in terms of buffers or anything else, just the pure gross amount of growth is 75 to 80 million board feet. We are currently the last few years where we're losing revenues, we're harvesting 5 to 7 million board feet. In the years leading up to the lawsuit we faced in 2013 that triggered that change where we started losing money, we were harvesting in the range of 20 to 30 million board feet. Towards the end of that decade, it was closer to 20 and in the teens. But
so, follow up.
Please.
So we're growing at a rate of 70 to 75 million board feet a year. Is that correct?
Over the last 3 or 4 years, yes.
But we're only harvesting 5 million board feet?
Over the last, yes, few years, that's the harvest level we have been at in the Elliott.
I might kind of have an inkling of why we're losing money.
Thank you.
Senator Girard, please.
Yeah, please bear with me. I'm new on this committee, but I am a little bit concerned about hunting rights of all the real property. Is there, I mean, do we allow hunting, or do, you know, in certain areas it's closed, or how does that work?
Yeah, Co-Chair Witt, Senator Girard, we do all of the public trust lands at the board's discretion are left open to the public unless they decide to close them. But the default is they're open, and they generally are open, which includes open to hunting and any dispersed recreation. The public is the land board does not close their lands as a practice to the public.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to move on to our trust property.
Well, maybe before you do, okay. I actually have a couple of questions, okay. too. You talked about the filled lands and sometimes confusion among property owners, whether they own it or the state does. What actions might a landowner undertake to his or her property that would result in it ending up as state ownership?
Co-Chair Witt, I think the question is what action would trigger the state to become aware or to take a look at that land and say, hey, we may have an ownership claim?
Yes.
The most typical action is actually just the putting a property up for sale, and the potential buyer does a search and asks to get title insurance, and the title company shows up that the state may in fact own the property. There's never it's along a waterway that's owned by the state, and it's unclear that there was ever the ownership from the state was transferred or released actually in the history of that property. And in most deed records and title search histories, there's a clause at the bottom that says sort of a disclaimer that if you own land alongside state-owned waterways, this may or may not be insured against a state ownership claim. But that's the most typical one, is where there's a property sale or exchange that's going to happen, and a seller or the purchaser discovers there may be they may not own the property as it's been advertised.
And so if I were to create land along a waterway or in a waterway, then that would be state-owned lands.
So that's a little bit different question. That's the category of new lands.
Okay.
If you were today to do that, there's a process for doing that. You would apply for two things. One, you'd apply for a removal fill permit, and then you would also put an application to purchase the state-owned land. Assuming you go through that process, then the transaction would occur and there would be no uncertainty around ownership. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. And then you mentioned the sale of lands, and you mentioned specifically a couple of acres in Hell's Canyon, I think.
Mm-hmm.
What is the process that the department goes through when it's going to sell lands? How is this made available to the general public?
Mm-hmm. So the process is actually on our website. You can go to a page that and find applications for various activities, and there's an application to purchase land, either submersible land or any other type of land the state owns. And that will trigger, on our side, that triggers we create a new application file, and we start walking through the process that I summarized mm-hmm. earlier. Yep, there's a public review period in there, so we get public input. We give notice to other agencies and other entities that are on that notice list.
All right, thank you. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Representative Power, please.
I see that because Department of Forestry is not being paid $1.8 million over the biennium, that's a net savings, as I understand it, to the state land department. Is that still reflected in this biennium, or was that for the 2015-2017 biennium only?
So, Co-Chair Witt, I'm not familiar with that number.
It's in the document we have with additional notes and background. It notes that I was curious which property would be captured under the real property program. It's a net savings, since forestry department's not managing the Elliott.
Okay, yeah, I'm tracking what you're saying. So what we what occurred in this proposed budget versus last biennium is we, with the pending sale of the Elliott, and a year ago, last June is when we needed to have our budget approved by our board. And at that time, we were in the midst of the protocol and were on a path to transfer the ownership of the Elliott. We determined that the path, the best approach to going down that path was we would adjust at the end of this biennium, adjust those lands that the Department of Forestry would continue managing for DSL. So right now they manage 117,000 acres. That includes the Elliott. As of July 1st, they will no longer be managing the Elliott, but they'll be managing the remaining acres, about 35,000 acres. So that number is really the reduction in terms of expenditures that we would have to pay them because they're not managing those lands for us any longer.
Okay. Which program subcategory is
that? It would be in this program. Yeah.
Mr. Stainer, did you have anything to add?
Co-Chair Witt, I think that Mr. Paul answered the question exactly. It's just the difference between what the agency pays for management to ODF and what ODF produces in revenue for the lands. And it produces a net savings of $1.8 million for the next biennium.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, so moving on to our trust property program. So this is where the department serves as a trustee for our unclaimed property and for estates with no will or known heirs. This program is a very completely different type of program than one we just talked about. This is principally a consumer protection program. With outreach and education components, we're working on and have worked on improved online services. And fundamentally, this is about where these monies that the department receives, either through unclaimed property or estates, sit in the fund and help in terms of distributions to schools while they're being held for the rightful owners. So our primary mission and purpose around these monies, first and foremost, is to find the rightful owners. And as we're doing that, those monies generate revenue for the Common School Fund and can help enhance distributions. Under our unclaimed property side of that equation, those monies we have to hold in perpetuity. So they will always be held there and have to be held for the rightful owners. Under the estates administration, there's a 10-year clock, so to speak. If the rightful heirs we're not able to find them or they're not able to find us, after 10 years, those funds will permanently escheat to the fund. That's a much smaller portion of the fund. We estimate it's somewhere in the 10 million, maybe 15 million range. We don't have an exact number on that, as opposed to the unclaimed property monies that are close to approaching $600 million in terms of that portion of the fund. We have 13 FTE in this program with a budget of $4.1 million, and we're take some a pride in saying actually this FTE number has stayed relatively constant for the last 6 to 8 years at least, while our receipts, unclaimed receipts that have come in have almost doubled, where the number of claims have significantly increased. We've seen a much higher workload over that time period, but we've tried to manage that workload and still have a good response time for claims, basically through IT improvements. We've gone from a paper system to an all-electronic system over the course of that time. That's been serving us well. We, in terms of our 2017-19 projects, we believe we still need to increase our education outreach efforts. There's room to improve there. Also develop a more simple tool for estates notifications. And I've just said, you know, we've made a lot of positive improvements around being more efficient and effective using IT infrastructure, but we think we've kind of maxed out as much as we can with our current tools, which we've had in place, I think, since 1999, our current software. And in 2017-19, we're going to be looking and doing planning around the best way to upgrade that software at some point in the near future. For our numbers for 2015, $51.5 million in unclaimed property was received. $22 million in claims were paid out. We had close to 19,000 claims paid, which was a 42% increase over the previous year. And in terms of our estates, we had 372 estates administered and close to $7 million that is pending, permanently escheating to the Common School Fund. So next I was going to move on to our Aquatic Resource Management Program. So the fundamental mission of this program, it's tied to our strategic plan goals, is the protection of Oregon's waters through removal fill and wetlands laws and protecting our public trust values on state-owned waterways. We do this through the administration of the removal fill permit program, overseeing our wetlands mitigation programs and that are required by permits, providing wetland conservation planning assistance, and managing our navigable waterways to preserve the public trust values. And those four values are fisheries, navigation, recreation, and commerce. We have, in terms of the operations side of this program, we have 22 FTE with a budget of $14.5 million, and our policy and planning part of this program, we have 4.5 FTE and $1.1 million budget. Our major programs, first and foremost, our Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup that we'll talk about in more detail tomorrow. We are also looking at improved community engagement in our aquatic resource planning and maintaining a sustainable program finance structure as we look to the future. This is sort of breaking those projects down more specifically in terms of what does that mean. So we're looking at implementing improvements to our mitigation program, upgrading our statewide wetlands inventory. So a big issue that we see, I think every biennium, and I've seen this from my understanding for probably a couple decades, is really misunderstanding or miscommunication around wetlands and identifying wetlands and properties and knowing when you have wetlands and when you don't. And we want to work towards ensuring as much as we can be as clear and transparent and notifying the public around our state wetlands inventories so we don't have these miscommunications and then have to deal with them after the fact. This is going to involve outreach, stakeholder outreach. The third bullet there is around developing an outreach plan for local and state agencies, landowners, and consultants. And then another issue we're dealing with is working with our agricultural community to simplify our process around maintaining drainage for agricultural wetlands. This has also been an issue lately, and probably for quite a while, where what are the rules of the game around drainage structures on ag lands that need to be cleaned out just from a perspective of keeping your ag lands drained, but how do we do that in the context of removal fill and make sure that it's being done in compliance with removal fill laws? We've been working actively with agricultural stakeholders over the last year to come up with ways to improve how we do that and improve the predictability around that. And then finally, develop and implement a plan for the removal of derelict and abandoned vessels. And tied to this is our POP around, POP 104 around the Submerged Land Enhancement Fund. That would help us. We'd use that for where we needed to clean up derelict vessels and our abandoned vessels on our state-owned waterways. A few numbers around for the program here in FY 2015, 839 permits. More than half of these were placer mining authorizations. Close to 900 wetland delineation reports reviewed, wetland determinations and wetland land use notices. And then on our 1.25 million acres of state-owned waterways, we currently have about 4,500 authorizations in place. About half of those authorizations are actual dock registrations, predominantly private homeowner dock registrations, and the rest are easements, leases, and then miscellaneous authorizations around special uses and short-term access, public facility license, and those types of things. Wanted to mention the three of the POPs related to the work of this program. First one, the big one, again, which we'll get into detail on tomorrow, is for Portland Harbor Cleanup. This is a POP we bring every 2 years and have for, I think, at least maybe a decade. Seems to get bigger every 2 years, but we'll explain sort of the reasons behind that. We have our POP 104, Submerged Lands Enhancement Fund. And as was mentioned earlier, this stems out of House Bill 2463 that actually created the authority to establish the fund, but did not provide any limitation to use the fund. And this is some limitation so we can use that fund. And this is to help us actually on the theme of being more proactive about managing our lands. This is to help us try and be more proactive about cleaning up issues on submerged and submersible lands that we are aware of and ensuring that we have the limitation to go out and address those situations when we identify them. And then POP 108 is on regional team office space. So this is around our goal number one from our strategic plan around being more responsive to the public and our customers. And the idea around this POP is to locate our staff closer to where where they're engaged in their work. Both minimizes time around commuting when they do have to go out in the field, and intent there is to make them more accessible to the public that are in that area that are needing help and are contacting us for that help. That was my last slide on the Aquatic Resource Management Program.
Senator Gerard.
I actually have a couple questions. Can you go back to the operations slide for Aquatic Resource Management? I'm missing something, because you have 22 FTEs and a $14.5 million budget. What else is in there besides salaries? Because I'm coming up with a salary at $329,000.
This is the Portland Harbor, right? Yeah. I thought I'd put it in my notes, but it wasn't there. I wanted to make sure. This is the $8.9 million Portland Harbor Superfund POP. Is in there.
Thank you. It makes it a little easier.
Yes, you're paying attention, though. That's good.
I'm a numbers guy. I always have been. Okay, the second question I have, and I did a development, and it's the redundancy between the Corps and state lands on both delineation and mitigation. Do we really need to have the state represented when the Corps is out there doing exactly the same thing? And how much money could we save if we did away with the delineation and mitigation program?
Yeah. So, Co-Chair Witt, Senator Gerard, that's an excellent question, and that's actually a question that's sort of squarely in the legislative purview, so to speak. Currently, and for a very long time, maybe for most of the history of the removal fill program. You're correct. There are two. There's a federal permitting process and there's a state permitting process. And generally, well, not always, I think it's fair to say generally that when an applicant goes through the state permitting process and comes out the other side and can move forward, generally speaking, the federal process goes very smoothly and efficiently, and there's not a lot of redundancy in terms of having to go through everything over again and waiting an extended period of time. Yeah, you're correct in that there is overlapping authority. So in theory, if there was no state program, the federal program would be there and the federal permitting would still be there to cover the same lands. How much money would be saved? I wouldn't want to speculate on that. Take some pride in as well is that we often get feedback that we're fairly responsive and more responsive than our federal partners, even though we work with them very well on a partnership level. But in terms of the customers and Oregonians, we sometimes hear that they appreciate how responsive and accessible we are, and they don't always experience that with the Fed. So, again, I don't know if there were not a state program or if the state program was pared down, whether there would be efficiencies gained either in cost to the applicant or time, but it's a fair question, and it's ultimately a question of, you know, in terms of the the statutes and what the desire of the state is in terms of that that work.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, business operations and support services. We have 28 FTE and $15.8 million in budget. And given the question we just received on the aquatic resource management, some of you might be wondering, wow, what is going on there? So what is going on there is that a significant piece of that $15.8 million includes non-limited funds. Non-limited funds in our budget, under this part of our budget, are in large part our expenditures that we pay the investment division at Treasury to manage the Common School Fund. It's close to, I believe, $10 million of that 15.8 is investment fees, basically investment charges for them to manage the $1.5 billion fund. And the way we account for those currently, and I know we're having discussions with LFO about whether that's the appropriate way moving forward, but up till now and currently, we net those out. So when we report our returns, that investment costs come out of that, and so we report net returns in terms of the investments of those dollars. But that's why that number is what it is. I don't know, Matt, is there anything else clarify on that?
Co-chair, members of the subcommittee, just to maybe provide a little bit of extra context, the total personal services budget in this particular division, the agency's current service level is roughly $5.1 million of the $15.8 million. So it works out to about $91,000 a year per FTE, fully loaded with all of the, with all
that
of
was
the,
my quest, next question.
With all of the costs, including retirement and insurance and so forth and so on.
Thank you.
Okay, so for our 2017-19 projects category, again, we're looking at implementing systems that are going to keep pace with technology and customer preferences. This is really around electronic access, website accessibility. So we're looking at expanding our electronic filing and records retention, trying to move more to a paperless system across the agency. I mentioned earlier, we are paperless within our unclaimed property work, but that's in parts of our real property work, but we have yet to make that the case across the entire department. And third bullet there, implement a customer engagement strategy and improve on our engagement with the public and our customers. We have three of our POPs here that are related to the work primarily of this this part of the department. POP 106 is a shared services pilot around payroll services that essentially will be sharing half of an FTE with other agencies to take care of our payroll services. POP 107 is to replace five vehicles, the leasing cost, we're replacing five vehicles that we've had for quite a few years. We acquired them, that they're owned by the Common School Fund, basically, that we've acquired over the years through estates that were unclaimed and ultimately were rather than selling those vehicles, we thought it was a way to be more efficient and effective. Those vehicles are run their course, and we need to shift back to the leasing approach. POP 110 is some additional monies towards our capital improvement budget for some issues we're dealing with on our headquarters building. Our headquarters building is owned by the Common School Fund, was built in the early 90s, and all of our net revenues from that building actually go towards the fund. But it's getting of that age where more repairs are needed. This is going to cover both fixing a permanent roof leak that we had to repair during last biennium temporarily, as well as updating our parking garage lighting that was done back in the early 90s and is both not as energy efficient nor very well lit. that is due for an upgrade as well. The last major program then to talk about is our South Slough Reserve. And this reserve is really a partnership between National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration and DSL. It is part of the National Estuarine Research Reserve Network. It was the first of 28 reserves nationwide. I think I said 26. It's 28 nationwide, established in 1974. Within the reserve itself is made up of about 5,000 acres, and then there's an additional 1,000 acres that's adjacent to but outside of the reserve, but is also managed by the reserve staff. We have 16 FTE and a budget of $3.7 million, so no big add-ons to that budget. The work of the reserve includes summer camps, public workshops. We have interpretive programs, educational events. We've got an interpretive center down there on the reserve, and we have quite a few collaborative partnerships that work to restore watershed habitats. And we're also recognized as one of the leaders in West Coast estuarine research. And if you've never been there, it's a really beautiful place to go. Highly recommend it. Some more numbers on the work of the reserve. More than 280 education interpretive programs, 21 training workshops. In 2015, we had close to 7,400 program participants, 4,386 visitors at the Interpretive Center, and we've got 21 research projects that were ongoing during that fiscal year. The 2017-19 projects are actually driven by the SLU's management plan. So they're required under their national estuary status to maintain a five-year management plan that they are right now updating and about to renew this year. And within that management plan, these projects, these bullets come directly from that. So develop and implement an education strategy to increase awareness and understanding of the SLU. Develop projects that promote habitat restoration and native plant communities in the South Slough and Coos Bay subregions, and examine potential administrative partners for hosting the South Slough. This last one is actually an initiative that we began under my predecessor, Director Mary Abrams, that we're continuing. We are essentially looking at ways that the South Slough might be better supported or potentially better fit under one or both of the universities. So we have an agreement right now that we're working through with both U of O and OSU to determine if that's true, if that's right, if they would have a better fit, and if they're both, one or both of those universities are interested in managing the SLU rather than having that be primarily a DSL managed managed operation. And just before I move on from that note, just that last bullet, we're very much in the early discussions about this. Any permanent change, if it were to occur, we're, you know, 4 or 5 years out. So we'll be hopefully by the end of the next biennium, we'll have a better sense as to whether we're going to move forward on that. And it wouldn't be until the 19 biennium where there might be some part of our budget that would come forward to look at a change. Yes. The South Slough is an asset of the Commerce School Fund. Those acres are owned by the state of Oregon. Yep. They were acquired in the 70s in large part through federal grants that allowed the state to purchase those monies for the purpose of maintaining that estuarine research reserve. So I wanted to talk just a little bit about major budget drivers agency-wide. I've got three I wanted to highlight, three bullets here to highlight. First is to increase revenue from school trust lands into the fund, looking at more efficient, effective operations and fund distributions in schools, so both stability and sustainability. One of our biggest projects around that one is the Elliott State Forest that has been a cost to the fund lately. and we want to turn that around. Obviously, the stability and sustainability piece in terms of the distributions, we're actually this year going to be taking a look at the land board's distribution policy, which it's been about 8 years since they last adopted the distribution policy, and that's about the time frame that historically the land board has just revisited it, just to check in and make sure that distribution policy still makes sense and is still going to meet the mandate. And the sustainability piece is really important in terms of the intergenerational equity, but what we hear from beneficiaries is the stability piece is just as important. A predictable, as much as we can have a predictable stream of distributions, the more they like to see that. Protecting Oregon's wetlands and waterways is a big driver right now as well, as it always is, but I think with our effort to try to be more proactive around doing that, specifically around the Submerged Lands Enhancement Fund and having the monies to go out and actually clean up and address issues rather than react, that's something we're trying to move to. And then just increase public outreach, really, in all of our programs, create a greater awareness of the agency's work with a staff of a little over 100, with a statewide coverage in so many issues. Sometimes we are challenged to in getting enough public outreach out and the word out to Oregonians around what we do. So budget risks. We, of course, have the Elliott State Forest again, Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup as well. And just on the Portland Harbor Superfund, one thing that we'll talk a little bit more about is really what the budget risks are, not just to DSL, but to the state as a whole, as we move from planning phase to actual, in the next few years, actual cleanup and cleanup costs. So that'll be part of the topic we'll talk about tomorrow. Legal challenges and agency decisions. So this has been a significant one. We've seen legal challenges in terms of our trust properties, principally the Elliott State Forest. We've had to deal with a few legal challenges lately, but we see regular legal challenges in terms of our removal fill, our aquatic resource management program. We currently have about a dozen ongoing legal actions, either challenges to decisions or actual lawsuits. In recent years, we're spending about $1 million a biennium on Department of Justice fees just to deal with those challenges. And sometimes those challenges we don't have, given the nature of a particular permit, really doesn't matter which way the decision goes. There are parties that are going to be unhappy one way or the other, and we have to prepare for defending our decision either way. So in some of those cases, we don't have a lot of control over those challenges. And then the fourth bullet there, potential federal government policy changes that specifically could be affecting the South Slough estuary. So what we're seen in terms of so far in terms of possible federal budget cuts could put the federal funding for the South Slough at risk completely. If the proposed cuts that we've seen today were to actually happen, we would essentially lose our federal funding, which is matching monies. So we would have to revisit really the slough itself and what to do with those lands and what to do with that program if those were come to be. 70% of the South Slough operations actually comes from federal dollars, so that could be a really big deal. I know we're just at the early stages of that, but that's something we're going to be watching definitely very closely. Environmental factors. These, I think, are probably the same environmental factors we probably brought to this committee 2 years ago. listed species on DSL lands are a big one. I've already talked about some of that issue around the sage grouse and how this conservation agreement we've signed is a real success, I think, in terms of limiting the impact of listed species to the fulfilling the mandate of those lands. And, of course, we're working through issues on the Elliott in terms of impact from listed species. Um, And then the second, drought impacts and wildfire risks. Again, this is really specific to our rangelands in the past. The drought impacts in the recent years have actually affected the level of revenues we can charge for our grazing fees. So we had to make some reductions in terms of our lease rates temporarily while the drought impacted the level of grazing that could occur, and then our wildfire risks. We, in fact, after the 2015 season, we had to deal with a very large wildfire bill, protection bill we received from the Bureau of Land Management. We have a contract with the Bureau of Land Management to protect our lands from fire, and we ended up with a $1.5 million expense during a particularly bad fire year. The years prior to that, we were in the $400,000 range a couple of those years. A normal fire year where we don't really see much activity, we might be spending $20,000 or $40,000 in terms of fire protection. So, depending on fire year, can have a really big impact on our revenues on those lands. And that's actually one thing we're looking at in the next biennium, is to come up with a better way to protect for fire, where we're not as likely to incur those kinds of charges for fire protection from the Bureau of Land Management. Just to summarize some of the significant agency changes in terms of looking back over the last few biennium. In 2014, we did a major agency reorganization, had a number of finance packages over the course of a biennium, and established our aquatic resource management teams into regional teams with multiple skills and positions within each of those teams, so we could better support customers and the public. And we also reduced our manager to staff ratios in that reorganization. In 2014 through 2017, of course, we underwent all the work around the Elliott State Forest, the precursor to the protocol, and then working through all of the protocol work that led up to where we sit today with the Elliott. And then, as I already mentioned, we've gone through updating our strategic plan with some significant updating in terms of our goals and objectives to set us up better for the next 5 years. And then a few points in terms of cost containment topic. One example I've already talked about is our shared services model for payroll. That we are looking at making permanent in our budget. Our business process improvements, again, as I talked about a little bit too, we are working on through our priorities we've laid out in our strategic plan, moving to more paperless processes and electronic processes to do our work. And then we continue to look towards energy efficiencies in our agency-owned headquarter building. We updated our heating and cooling system a few years ago, and then did some additional updates when we over the last biennium to the building itself to modernize our temperature controls for the building that were still under the 1990s technology, and we brought it up current. And as I mentioned, we're looking at continued improvements with our capital improvement POP that I talked about earlier. And this is a chart just out of our budget in terms of just looking back at the history of DSL's budget. You can see predominantly other funded budget, which we fund through Common School Fund, both the revenues we generate operationally for the fund, as well as the investment returns on the fund. We have a little minority piece of our budget that is federal funds, and the large majority of that is for the South SLU, although there is a portion of that does fund our wetland mitigation work. And I do want to point out there a couple of anomalies, I will say, on this chart that explain what you're seeing there. That large spike in 2007-2009 was because of settlement monies the agency received because of the new Carissa. Those of you that remember the new Carissa washing up on the South Coast shore and the cleanup costs for that. We had a big influx of money from that settlement that then immediately was spent to clean up the new Carissa. And there's an, and then, so that was the jump up in 09, and then we came back down in 9/11. But then you also see a significant jump between 09/11 and 11/13. And this was actually due to just an accounting adjustment in terms of how we were accounting for actual our dollars in our budget to make sure we were accounting for our investment expenses in accordance with our with appropriate accounting standards. We had and I believe that had to do with our investment. Was that our investment? Yeah, our invest. So the non-limited expenses that I mentioned earlier essentially accounts for that roughly $10 million dollars there. And then even with that, though, you can see kind of an increase and uptick amidst those two events. And that remaining sort of increase in our budget is really being driven by the Portland Harbor defense costs, again, which we'll talk about more tomorrow as being a larger part of our budget in recent biennium. So just a couple, actually just one more slide here to get through before plan was to pause until tomorrow. This last slide simply just shows you over the last three biennia, including, last two biennia plus the governor's recommended budget, where we are at in terms of our budget. And I just, in terms of the positions, if you look at the 103 to 110 to 108, we in fact, in reality, have been right at about 107 positions. And the reason for that variability are because of some of the finance packages that we had when we reorganized and just the time lag between those packages and then some adjustments that had to, technical adjustments that were made in our budgeting. But we've been very constant at 107 positions. And that variance is just an anomaly of the system in terms of tracking changes over time. And I think that was the main point I wanted to make from that slide. Though the other piece, too, if you'll see that $40.2 million in recommended budget does not include the non-limited monies that we referenced earlier. That would put it close to the $50 million mark. But just to be aware of that as well. So if you were to add up the numbers in the different programs from earlier in the slides, it would be the difference is because of those non-limited monies. And with that, that was all I had today until we were going to talk again tomorrow about both Elliott and the Portland Harbor Superfund.
That's pretty tremendous timing. Subcommittee members, I'd like, if you have questions or comments, to hold those until tomorrow. If there's any information that you would like to request that you see, Senator Girard.
Yes, if you could get me an amount that could be saved by not doing duplicative services with the Corps on delineation and mitigation.
I will see what would you like that by tomorrow or just
as soon as reasonable,
we can get it to you. We'll work to put that together.
Before the gavel hits on your final, when we
before the gavel hits, okay.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, briefly, would you be able to get to me the difference between what you're harvesting out of the Elliott, and let's say you did 85% of the growth of the Elliott and log and harvested that timber? What's the difference between the monies that's going into the coffers?
Common school fund.
Yeah. I want to know how much money that is.
We can get an estimate on that. Yep.
Anyone else? And if we could get a 30,000-foot level look at the investment portfolio.
Okay.
All right.
I'm happy to do that.
And with that, I'm going to close today's public hearing on Senate Bill 5537, and we stand adjourned.
Thank you, sir.
37, and we stand adjourned.
Thank you, sir. 55-